I'm Ellis Sandoz from Louisiana State University, and I'm chairing this final session on Can Leviathan Be Tamed? I think that the contrivers of this program wanted to try to make the last session sound especially exciting, since it's being held at 4 o'clock on Saturday afternoon within one block of Bourbon Street. Thirst seems to be running strong, and entertainment is not far to seek. But we come to the conclusion then of our session. I had thought that there was some sort of typographical error here. In a recent trip to Canada, I opened the Globe and Mail from Toronto and found the United States regularly referred to as the behemoth to the south. I didn't exactly know what that meant, but I took it to be unfavorable. I believe that Can Leviathan Be Tamed, after all I've heard, maybe even more unfavorable, particularly since I was unaware that Leviathan was really with us until I saw those slides last night. I imagined we lived in a constitutional republic. I remember that there was some sort of ratification process that we went through to establish the Constitution on the basis of a revolution that took its rise from the Declaration of Independence, which proclaimed certain things to be self-evident truths that perhaps we've forgotten. I've tried to remember what it was Thomas Hobbes, who's imagined to be one of the founders by my friend Gary McDowell, who happily is resting in England right now, having asserted that Hobbes might have been one of the founding fathers, which I did seriously question him about. But Hobbes, after all, created the symbolism of Leviathan as a political symbol, and he did so in the midst of a civil war. And it's an emblem of a collectivist state designed to break the pride of fanatical zealots intent upon the destruction of the realm. I don't see the analogy, however much we deplore much that transpires in this country or has transpired. Hobbes, in his dedicatory epistle for Francis Godolphin, wrote, "I know not how the world will receive it, nor how it may reflect on those that shall seem to favor it, but in a way beset with those that contend on one side for too great liberty and on the other side for too much authority, 'tis hard to pass between the points of both unwounded." So he was a man trying to save his country at a time of civil war. We find our meeting rather fortuitously at a time when another sort of war is afoot, which is rather different from this, although zealotry and fanaticism have their parts. The symbol of Leviathan has become, in political literature, an easy prototype for what in the 20th century we call totalitarianism. The total state. The integrity of the individuals that were causing all the trouble in the Hobbesian state in the 17th century that he called the state of nature surrendered their personhood through something that was more than a covenant so that the sovereign might be constituted. Americans never did that and haven't yet done it. Otherwise, perhaps even in a sedate society such as the Philadelphia Society, we wouldn't be finding calls for taking to the streets to enforce our liberties, whether in communities or individually. So our spirit's not yet broken, I don't think, even though, likewise, our pride may still be rather strong and intact. Now, to be sure, war has a way of augmenting civil power at the expense of the liberty of the individual citizens and of the community as a whole. It did in the past, and it does now, and I think at this particular juncture, it's a great fear that all of us have, as rather extravagant claims are being said about how our society will have to be managed in the future. Perhaps a rather lengthy process. Of course, this is put forward as the price of survival, but this is not a conclusion we should rush to embrace. Great bureaucracies are not great custodians of precious liberties of free men. The term free man, so far as I know, has its constitutional lineage back to Magna Carta, the Liber Homo of Magna Carta in 1215. It is a heritage upon which our whole constitutional fabric is erected and which is a living memory on the part of those who have fashioned the liberties that all of us enjoy as being conceived as liberty under law in a way that harmonizes with the law of nature and nature's God. Whatever Jefferson may or may not have meant by that, a faithful community understood it in a biblical sense. Most of the centralization of authority in the United States from the end of the Civil War or the late unpleasantness or however we wish to designate that event, and since I'm a native of this city, I know something of the folklore of the treatment that Ben Butler received here, and rightly so, and we all have stories that we can recall when we think of atrocities in this part of the country. We think of Sherman's march to the coast as being perhaps the analogy to the disaster of this past week in terms of human destruction inflicted upon the American community, a comparable event. Most of the centralization in the USA from the end of the Civil War into the present arose in response to some kind of national emergency, military and economic, prefaced by the dismantling of the federal system during Reconstruction. I do think it's at least an arguable proposition that our liberties, as Sir Henry Maine fetchingly remarked, are secreted in the interstices of procedure, and that the intervening institutions that we talked about last time in terms of subsidiarity, that we understand in terms of the various jurisdictions that crisscross our republic and which were the source of liberty during the medieval constitution, that this kind of dismantling of the force and the power and the authority, the integrity of our system of federalism was a serious blow against the institutionalization of liberty under law in this country as originally conceived by our founding fathers. But nonetheless, the federal system is, in its vague and shadowy evocation, still with us and still a vital part of our constitutional order, whether it's the federal system or the new federalism or the new federalism or whatever you want to call it. We're too refractory to give it up entirely or to succumb completely to the process of centralization. And centralization does seem to be a thing to worry about in terms of the dissolution of liberty in a community. Tocqueville taught that the destruction of French liberty in his Ancien Régime arose through the centralization of France in the 17th and early 18th century, long before the revolution itself, so that a centralized administration was in place that then could serve its purpose in later times, being capped with the Napoleonic period, perhaps. The slogan of much of the conservatism that many people in this room have espoused in times past, the conservatism of Reagan and Thatcher, is a conservatism of that espouses a proposition of minimal government of any kind. The smaller government is, the better. And most of us applauded somewhat enthusiastically that proposition. And we still do. And it's perhaps an irony that perhaps with an administration in Washington now that might have been dedicated to such a proposition, that fortune has dealt a different hand to American government than one that we would have liked and would like to have seen, whether the 14 elements of reducing the size of government and the reach of government that were announced 2 weeks ago by the White House, the week before the disaster, might have been implemented, which now seems to be something that's beyond the reach of this administration. Nonetheless, even beforehand, there's been a furious debate from the side of those who are interested in this sort of reduction of governmental reach. Writers with a fondness for collectivism and social welfare argue the impossibility of a minimalist government as being simplistic thinking. I think of even absent war and the economic crisis, because of the conditions of modern social and political activity. I think of our old friend John Gray at Oxford, a laissez-faire, conservative, true believer for a long time, who made the switch shortly after he published his book, Beyond the New Right. And John, whatever else you want to say about him, is a serious thinker about issues that are of interest to us. And he said in this volume about 9 or 10 years ago, the ultimate locus of value in the human world is not in individual choices, but in forms of life. This should lead us to qualify, even to abandon, the ideal of the autonomous chooser. The free individual personality in my vocabulary. In favor of the recognition that the good life for human beings necessarily presupposes embeddedness in communities. It is not individual rights, but often forms of life that need most protection, if only because it is upon them that individual well-being ultimately depends. I reviewed the book, and I rather facetiously, since I've known John a while, said John has gone so far right, he's come round left. Within a month, he had joined the Labor Party. Apparently, the hunch was right. And perhaps a conscientious man wrestling with the task of modern governance has to take to heart the sorts of reflections that prompted Gray to make a switch of that sort. Now, of course, we meet under the cloud of events of last week, which have grieved us and stunned us. I want to say a word or two. It was spoken to by Gene Genovese in his luncheon address to some degree. The fragility of our economic and our social order is evidenced by the impact of three airplane crashes and what has happened in the stock market and the fact that about 30-something persons who would have come to this meeting otherwise are not here. The economic and social and political immediate impact suggests the fragility of a social and political order. And that includes our own, which is well established and rooted and is traditional, and where there is no organized insurrection going on yet. So a word or two about who these people are who apparently have done this, and how we might think of them. And if the Secretary of State and the President are to be credited, the key personality is Osama bin Laden. In trying to get a grasp of what we're talking about, certain terms that are baffling to the non-specialist are being used. Taliban, what's a Taliban? Well, this translates students of religion. That's the Taliban. You have Islam. What's Islam? Islam is submission to the will of Allah in its simplest meaning. There is the implication historically that some of you would be much more expert in than I of undertaking to establish a heaven on earth through an ecumenic empire. The jihad struggle or striving, jihad, the internal jihad, which is to live in accordance with the words of the Quran and the traditions of Islam, and the external jihad, which is to strive and to conquer those who are not part of the Islamic community. Now, Osama bin Laden is a religious fanatic, we would say. I would say rather than a courageous man. He is a intelligent, charismatic personality. He's something of a Robin Hood figure to rank and file Muslims in some parts of the Middle East. What I've read of his authorship are the two fatwas. The fatwa, the edict, the judicial edicts of 1996 and 1998, which are extremely instructive documents. From these, you arrive at information, the conclusion that he is a true revolutionary. And in both of these fatwas or edicts, he calls for a jihad against the polytheists and the crusaders who occupy Saudi Arabia. The polytheists is a synonym for the pagans. I think that's us. We're scripturalists under Islamic law, but to a certain degree, as much as the rest of us, we ourselves might say the process of deculturation, we have substantially lost the Christianity which identifies the Western community. The term crusader, however, arises from the fact that the occupying forces in Saudi Arabia that are American, particularly, bring to mind the crusades of the Middle Ages, which were preached and which were conducted by force of arms from west to east. And so in the shorthand of this vocabulary, we are polytheists and crusaders. So the war is framed in terms of the millennial struggle of Muslim versus Christian conflict from the time of the life of the prophet to the defeated Tours or Poitiers, the expansion of the Ottoman Empire, a process of long conflict and sometimes alliance in world affairs running down through the period of World War I. In these fatwas, there is an evident and express contempt for the United States, for America, and for the superpowers more generally. It is derisive from the standpoint of bin Laden. Having defeated the Russians, who claim to be a superpower, they can defeat America, which also pretends to be a superpower. Yes, but we did it for the well-being and the preservation of Saudi Arabia. You did it for oil, they say, he says, and his associates say. So the purpose underlying these terrible events of last week is to rally a new movement within Islam and reestablish the Islamic State in a way which commands the respect of the world and which fulfills the destiny of Islam as viewed by a fragment and fringe group which seems to be partly at least directed by this particular personality. So there's an eschatological dimension to this. This is political religion with a vengeance, and as it is conceived by those with whom we are now dealing, whether we like it or not. So the Islamic East confronts a Western West that has largely, in their view, abandoned its own faith and has been ravaged by ideologies of left and right over the past century. Eviction of Americans and Jews from Saudi and from the Muslim soil generally is the immediate objective by means of a jihad or holy war, inciting every Muslim to kill every one of us he can, expressly stated in the fatwa. No ambiguity whatever. Solution, well, recovery of the foundation of liberty that was spoken of by Klaus Wren in our opening statements. In other words, if we are to envision some sort of response that is going to be morally adequate, it will mean the reconstitution of the moral foundation of the Republic. And the moral foundation of the Republic was not generated politically or constitutionally only. It was generated, we would say, intellectually and spiritually and particularly religiously. You think of Burke's address on conciliation in March of 1775 about the temper of the Englishman in America. And that temper is a matter of the foundations upon which our free government was erected. Is that a feasible enterprise? Well, if the struggle against terrorism is not the work of a day, reconstituting the moral and spiritual foundations of the Republic is perhaps an even bigger challenge. But nonetheless, this is not a presupposition. I'm a little bit weary, I would say, myself, of the mea culpas, these are just desserts. For the United States, I'm a little dissatisfied with certain of the evangelical Christian responses. Self-flagellation is not a mode of behavior that I find especially congenial. When people, without provocation, fly airplanes into large buildings in Manhattan an attempt to destroy as far as possible the military and governmental centers of our country. They have to be dealt with. But meantime, the self-critique that some people are urging us to partake of is something that we need to take, in my judgment, seriously. Now, we're going to be enlightened and perhaps led from our perplexity in all things by two speakers, Paul Gottfried and Alan Carlson, both of them well known to you, I think. Paul Gottfried was educated at Yale, has held several academic appointments, is a widely published author, commentator, journalist, and member of the executive board of the Historical Society. In 1999, he published an impressive book entitled After Liberalism, and he has a sequel in press on multiculturalism and the politics of guilt. Paul Gottfried.